Meet Natural Cycles, the only FDA-cleared and CE-marked birth control app that's 100% natural, hormone-free, and side-effect-free. Here's how it works. The app analyzes daily changes in your body temperature to find your fertile window so you can plan or prevent pregnancy naturally. Natural Cycles is a clinically proven non-hormonal birth control option that's 93% effective with typical use and 98% effective with perfect use. No synthetic hormones, just science. And if you're ready to start family planning, switching from preventing to planning a pregnancy is as easy as tapping a button. Plus, the Natural Cycles app makes tracking fertility easy. You can measure your temperature trends using an Oura Ring, Apple Watch, or our Bluetooth thermometer, which is free when you sign up for an annual subscription. Join over 4 million registered users who are taking control of their fertility naturally. Save 15% when you sign up with code RADIO15 at naturalcycles.com. That's RADIO15 for 15% off today.
Folks, welcome back to the iHealth channel, iHealth Radio, with your host, Hurricane H, new day, new show, a topic we all need, a topic that there's not enough discussions, no matter how we discuss it. And, you know, we just need it more and more and more in our lives because we carry difficult, you know, our days, our times today are just too busy and expectation is high. And so I have a question, and that is, do you ever wonder how to live in the present moment and live your best life, especially in times of high anxiety? And especially, you know, because we have expectations of performance from you. Well, if you have that question in your mind, well, I have someone today that's going to guide us through this because this is what he does. I have with me guest Peter Ekonomou, and he is a PhD assistant professor of the Department of Applied Psychology and the Director of Behavioral Health and Wellness for Rutgers University Athletics. Dr. Ekonomou, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Hurricane. It's going to be a good conversation. And please, Dr. Pete will be a lot easier. You won't stumble on it. The name is difficult. It's all good.
All right. No, I'll take that. Well, Dr. Pete, thank you so much. And, you know, one thing I didn't mention is that you also have your own podcast, so On Air with Dr. Pete, Dr. Ekonomou, or Dr. Peter, right?
Pete. See, I keep it simple.
I like that. So, listen, folks, you know, of course, you know, you do want to check that because I'm sure there's plenty of stuff we're going to cover an hour here, but you can take a lot more with him on his show as well. So welcome to the show, man.
It's happy to be here. It's going to be awesome. Let's go.
Well, so that question, right? I mean, life is crazy these days. I mean, I don't know if it was always crazy in the past in history. Obviously, people had to hunt to do things. I mean, I'm talking way back. But today, we just have a lot of expectation placed upon us for anything. Yeah. I mean, people just, they want you to behave a certain way and talk a certain way. And that's a pretty powerful hit that we all get as humans, and especially on my, you know, the mental state and the psyche, you know. But before we go into all this stuff, if you don't mind, doctor, if you can just share with us a little bit how you got into this whole world. I mean, this is a pretty interesting world that you're in. And you and I, we just had that brief discussion about, like, how do you even, I mean, you were joking about, like, you know, I get paid to listen to people. Yeah. So let's talk about that. We'll get you into it. And then we can go into the actual question that's, on stage right now.
Awesome. Yeah, I grew up in a family of athletes, and so I was always around high performance. Both my older brothers played baseball at high levels, and then I kind of was always looking for my own thing, and then I actually started swimming, and I swam at the highest levels and, you know, had a relatively successful career. And as far as psychology goes, it just, I don't know, I was actually, like, living my life, and, you know, it was good, and I was considering going back to grad school, and all of a sudden a friend of mine who's very influential just said, hey, why don't you consider getting a degree in psychology while you're here in the United States, because you can use it. And I was like, all right, cool. And that's what I did. And at that time I was, like, doing the, you know, acting and modeling in New York. And so with that always comes a little bit of bartending or, you know, something in the hospitality field. And it was fun. And then went and got my grad degree, and through that, I just gravitated towards high performers. You know, it was just somebody that I was very comfortable with. And now really in the last like decade, it's kind of blown up, you know, as far as the normalization of these conversations around mental health, especially within the world of sports.
Well, thank you. Well, that's the thing. I mean, that word is very diverse, right? I mean, there's so much stuff going on, and you know, you're in the limelight. I mean, you as an athlete, right? You always have to perform, you know, 200%, 1,000%. I mean, you know, from the moment you join a team, for example, to you know, all the exhibitions that you have in the tournaments and, you know, whatever it is. I mean, we got Super Bowl coming up. So, you know, I can just imagine the pressure that these guys are on right now. I mean, and the pressure they've been on. Now you chose psychology, I mean, as a means to assist, you know, with these folks. And again, you being, as you said, modeling and all the stuff, you've been exposed to some of that pressure. And by the way, I think everybody has been exposed to that. Like, that's what I said. I mean, our society today is just like, no matter what, I don't care what you do for a job, someone is going to be all over you.
especially in the Northeast. I always say it's the culture and the geography of what's next. You know, so like, what's the next best job? What's the next best house? What's the next best partner romantically? You know, it's really hard to kind of understand when you've arrived at success because it's a finish line that's constantly moving.
Wow. Well, that is true. I mean, again, I would say Northeast and probably the other side. I mean, the West, like the LA area.
We talked about that actually. So my other podcast is When East Meets West, and my co-host there, Dr. Rubin, like we talked about that because we do look at like the East Coast, West Coast differences, but also like Eastern spirituality. That's now the mindfulness stuff that I'm sure we'll talk about today. And so it is probably in LA, but New York area is definitely more prominent.
New York is a hub. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, there's that saying, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere, right? And there's a reason. And believe it or not, there's a joke. I mean, people ask me about where did I get my hurricane age. It's really because of that New York attitude. Because I went in Pennsylvania and the pace was too slow. Yeah. And I was like, I was coming out like, you know, the hurricane. And so that's kind of how I got that whole little alias, you know. And
I love it.
But you're right. It is a different pace. I mean, you have to be. It's like, you know, it's a moving train and you just got to hop on and you got to maintain. It's like unbelievably, you know, fast. And it takes a toll on people. And not everybody can take that pace, especially if you're not used to it. And now certainly, you know, people have a choice. You can get an easier flow, right? Yeah. Or you can get a faster flow. Now, a faster flow, there's more opportunities, as you said. There's what's next? And you can move left, right, you know, and you can do a lot of things. And so that also creates a lot of opportunity. But with that, there's stress, anxiety, you know, there's depression that can also happen if you don't achieve certain things. Now, in the world of athletics and sports, you know, what are some of the key components that these athletes have to really be aware of and careful from?
Well, I like that you preface that with like stress, anxiety, depression, because that's exactly why I went for a mental health degree. And that's exactly why when I'm mentoring students or developing programs, academic programs, it's important that we're looking at the mental health because that's what performance is, in my opinion. There is a school of thought in the world of sport performance where you can just do performance, you know, things like visualization, routines, you know, I just don't understand that because there's always something more complicated in people's lives. You know, I don't know. And this is where like my Eastern Zen practice comes in. Everybody suffers. And so I don't know how anybody at any limelight, at any level of performance is going to negate anything around their mental health to then think that they're just going to work on performance. It has to be holistic and comprehensive. And to me, that's where mental health and the performance are beautifully married.
Is there a special attribute or characteristic that separates, you know, the athletes from the rest, you know, that makes them who they are, that they have some tolerance and some resistance or resilience rather, you know, in their world? Or it just that's something that they acquire by training and by determination? How does that all work?
Well, you use the right word, resilience. I mean, I think that is not a one size fits all. And, you know, what makes you resilient is different for me and so on. You know, performance is performance. And so whether you're like a really white collar CEO or like engineer, you know, who might not understand sport or even exercise for that matter, you still know what it takes. And, you know, you have some kind of nobody that's super successful is working 9 to 5. You know, like that's
true.
Right. Like that's another thing. So when people are kind of punching in, punching out, it's, you know, obviously when people are, you know, because even those that have arrived, you know, and I always like to joke and say like fly private. You know, if you're flying private, you're not working 9 to 5. You know, you're constantly on. There's some sort of thing that you have to attend to. And so that's probably the difference. You know, I'd say the only difference between like business and sport is that in sport, everyone's kind of like that, especially like in the top like 5 to 10%. You know, everyone's kind of doing the same thing. They're grinding. You know, there's no like, you know, days off sort of don't exist anymore. Now, insert Dr. Pete, and I'm trying to help them find a day off and understand that balance is important because you have to be moderate in how you approach this. You have to have other things going on in your life than just your sport or then, you know, just your work. You have to have balance.
Well, so let's talk about that, the balance itself. I mean, how do you manage that? Because, you know, it's not you. I mean, as you said, you know, success. I mean, well, first of all, someone can debate the 9 to 5, says, well, because that's a whole definition, right? You know, what's right. success, right? And someone totally. can say, well, I'm successful the way I see it. You know, that's what I want. And that's okay, because right. that's the way the route they But for someone that actually aspires to more, and you're right, I mean, there is no 9 to 5, it's 24/7. Right. You're always on call. And yes, I mean, it comes with a price, you know, and luxury, but you have to sacrifice something. There's no free ride, right? So, right. yeah, that's just a fact. But so in that world, you know, of, you know, that expectation, what can someone do to balance life? I mean, certainly, you know, there is, I mean, because here's the thing, we hear stories about drugs, about, you know, things that they fill, you know, with so they can continue going at that rate, you know, and what is the mental toll that actually happens to them when they actually get really into that pressure?
Yeah, it's a significant mental tool. I mean, so two questions there. So I'll answer one in terms of substance use. I love that you brought that up because that is something we see often. And, you know, historically, you and I are probably similar ages. And so, like, you know, that some of these rock stars that we maybe grew up with who are no longer with us is because of the substance use. And it did take that substance to, you know, A, keep going, but B, sometimes to deal with, say, performance anxiety. You know, I was talking to some colleagues last night. We were out for dinner and we said, like, my one friend's wife used to sing, but one time like the band messed up and it really kind of affected her, and so she never did it again. And it was like, well, that's not uncommon, and that's why a lot of these kind of performers use substances to even get on stage or to kind of keep going. And so again, that's one piece of it. In terms of balance, I would say what we use, especially from the approach, holistic wellness approach I take, is value-based living. And so values, I like to conceptualize them as a bunch of different buckets. And so buckets like environment, recreation, socializing, romance, finance, you know, how do you kind of stay holistically grounded? And sometimes buckets overflow and sometimes they're empty. And so you have to like look at trying to maintain balance within those buckets. And that's what will kind of bring some peace and equanimity.
Well, but that takes also support, right? You know, it's not a one thing. I mean, it's not yourself. I mean, as an athlete, you do have other people, as you said. So whoever you're affecting in your life, your entourage, your family, you know, that needs to also kind of match your flow, because if not, you know, you're going to have almost, you're going to deviate from maybe the goals.
Yeah.
How do you kind of navigate through that with athletes, you know, and kind of help them kind of balance that as well? You know, maybe they have to make a different choice of friends. I don't know. I mean, because we see a lot of that, you know, you join the wrong crew and you have problems, right? Or you make it the news, right? So how does that work in terms of, you know, the guidance and the, I guess, the coaching to that level?
Yeah. You know, value-based living doesn't mean you just stay with people because they're loyal to you, or you evaluate things. You're constantly evaluating things. And we are communal beings, but there's an assumption that we need other people, you know, and I agree that we do. But I think the work I do is helping people figure out themselves individually, you know, and personally without other people, you know, and then connect with, you know, thereafter. And not, you know, show me a family, Hurricane, that's not dysfunctional. You know, you know, like, that's not a judgment. It's just what it is. Like, there's always dysfunction in any person's family. And so, you know, and if you're watching Netflix quarterback series or Aaron Rodgers series, you sort of see that at a high level where, you know, he's estranged from his family, you know, and talks about that on that series. So it's not uncommon. And so you may have to kind of develop additional or other unique kind of supports. And it doesn't have to look like a one size fits all. So it might not be like, you know, family, for example. I think there's ways that you could build support without, you know, even in dysfunction, you can kind of build support. But that's a good point.
Thank you. Now, on that first question I started with, like the idea of living the moment, you know, I mean, we are literally living one moment at a time, you know, but for an athlete, for example, they have to always be ahead of the game. Now, while you live in the moment, you still have to figure out everything. And by the way, not just an athlete. I mean, if you're, as you said, a successful person, mm-hmm. you know, you always are planning for the next move, as you said, especially in the East. You know, and by the way, that applies to a lot of other places around the world. I mean, this show is worldwide. So someone can say, well, this is not just you guys. I mean, we have that in Europe. We have this in the Middle East. We have this in Asia, right? So, I mean, you look at a place like Japan. Yeah. They're super fast. I mean, they're just like they're robotic in a lot of ways, yeah. right? I mean, but that's how they develop their culture in terms of, you know, the modern age, right? So it's a lot of stuff's going on. But so how does someone really just kind of live in the present while they are also working towards the next move?
Well, when you said that everyone's in the present moment, I think that is one of the hardest things to actually do. So I don't know that in today's world, we're actually in the present moment. I think, and that's my Eastern stuff coming into my training and meditation, because a lot of us, the suffering that we have is from holding on to something from the past or worry about the future. And I think one of the hardest things is, like, say for an athlete, how do I actually stay in the present moment? Which means if I just messed up a big play in the Super Bowl, how do I let that go and get on to the next play? That's really what makes that is what optimizes performance. And if that were easy, we would have more elite athletes because we beat ourselves up. And so, you know, we are the skill of letting that go is absolutely one of the most challenging thing for people to do.
So can we maybe extract the idea of failure in there? Like, you know, because I mean, that's a big one, right? So yeah. Fear of failure is probably the worst of anyone out there has that at any level. And I yeah. think for the athletes, as you said, I mean, if you fail, you know, a moment or a move or a play, you know, that can really affect you negatively. And we can see it. Sometimes someone makes the wrong move. And if someone looks at them or like screams at them, whatever, they might just kind of lose the cool. And then therefore their performance sucks after that. Right. Yeah. So what kind of training that will take to get someone to really focus and not, you know, look at that part. I mean, certainly, as you said, and I love what you said, because that's true. I mean, we tend to hang on to the past, and that creates a lot of anxiety, depression. And we tend to also, you know, worry about the future, that creates the anxiety piece. But to balance it out, especially when someone is afraid that, you know, if I make the wrong move, how am I going to be judged? I mean, again, the Super Bowl is a good example. Everybody's got expectations from these teams. And tomorrow, whatever the case may be, well, not tomorrow, the following week, it's going to be rough, right? It's going to be a lot. The preparation right now is going to be just brutal for them. Mm-hmm. And so all this stuff. So how do we kind of get someone to kind of really, from your perspective, of course, and are there any techniques that apply to, maybe they can even be, like, not stolen, but, you know, borrowed to other type of industries or other types of jobs?
Well, that's why I'm here. I mean, I love getting the message out and for ways to practice, and absolutely, like, I work with a lot of Fortune 10 companies, and they'll bring in, just for whether it's a diagnosis of what's going on in the organization or just some sort of improved performance, and so it's not a one size fits all. But I think it just really takes people to be able to understand sort of what it is. You talked about fear of failure, and that is something. I'll say that there's also the other side of it, was fear of success. And so some people are really fearful of actually succeeding, you know, because of their core belief. Their core belief might be like, I'm not good enough, or depending on what kind of trauma or their family challenges that they may have had, it kind of rewrites how we see ourselves at the core. And I do see that often, where there could equally be a fear of success.
Well, so, Doctor, you mentioned something, I think, about mindfulness.
Yeah.
Right. So how does that even get into the discussion? I mean, being mindful, it's pretty deep. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, how does someone know that they're mindful of things and their presence and their real existence, in a way, right? Yeah. And again, that goes back to that moment. We exist one moment at a time. Yet, yes, we do link to the past and the previous moments, and maybe are eager for the next one. But really, being mindful, I mean, it reminds me of Star Wars. Be mindful of your surroundings, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So how does that work, in the real world of athletes in general?
Yeah, it's a word that definitely has gotten, used. When I was first doing this about 15 years ago clinically, people didn't know what it was, and they would kind of look at me funny when I would like meditate with them or ground our feet or do some sort of practices in session. Today, everyone's heard the word mindfulness. Jon Kabat-Zinn defined it as doing what you do on purpose in the present moment and without judgment. And so I'll break that down. Whatever you're doing, you know, and on purpose, meaning if I'm just peeling the potatoes, just peel the potatoes. Like, you don't have to be thinking about the salmon and are they going to like it? And just do what you're doing on purpose, because you want to cook, you need to eat, you need to nourish your body. In the present moment, you know, feel your feet when you're peeling the potatoes, smell the potatoes, where the potato come from, who picked it, you know, watch the skin come off of it as you're peeling it. You know, and do that also in the present moment, where you're like, not, you're letting go. You know, if you had an argument with your boss at work from the past, or you're worried about who's even coming over for dinner, just stay in the present moment and do so without judgment. And so that's the other piece of this that's really hard for high performers. And humans are meant to judge. That's our frontal lobe. That's developmentally kind of keeps us alive as a species. So you want to know what's right and wrong and dangerous and not. But the brain's not always right. You know, the brain, you know, will judge things in all kinds of ways. So building a relationship with that part of your brain that's always judging is really key.
Well, I mean, it sounds like we have to immerse ourselves into that particular thing that you focus on, because there's two schools of thoughts out there, right? There's like, you know, someone can be focused, laser focused, and someone, there's also the school like, well, multitasking, for example, do a lot of things at the same time.
Sure.
And, you know, so there's two different things. Is it, in your opinion, better to actually focus, as you said, to one thing and really just be mindful of the whole thing, as opposed to being mindful of a lot of things and not focus on anything? And yeah. And if there is a difference, which strategy would we probably, you know, be ideal for us?
Well, research tells us we can only do one thing at a time. And so when people think they're multitasking, they're not. And so that's usually the biggest sort of awakening that I do with clients I work with, because the brain's unable to attend to more than one thing. Now, there are listeners that are going to say like, oh, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. I just did five, you know, this morning. You know, when you really break it down in neurologically, like, all you can do is one thing at a time. And so trying to come to terms with that, accept that, and then work with that will make you more efficient. You could have lists or things to kind of keep you on task, but there is no such thing as multitasking.
Yeah, you know, so I love that, because you're right. It's the perception of doing, like, let's say we take this moment, I can be doing multiple things at the same time, but I am doing literally one thing at a time within that time frame.
Correct.
So it's really, I think that's where it gets lost. It's not like, you know, yeah, you can do execute five things back to back, you know, and in a fairly small time frame, but you still are doing one thing at a time. Your brain is only activating one piece. You're moving one piece at a time. You're moving the other one, the next, and so on. So you're doing steps. And I think I love the way you said it, because you're right. So, because there's a big debate about that. Like, you know, you know, is it even worth it? Like, and some people's like, oh, I can multitask. You know, what's the benefit of multitasking? Yeah. It does get you distracted, if anything. And if you're not organized, you mess it up, right? Yeah. But at the end of the day, as you said, neurologically speaking, it's one synapse at a time firing, you know, to the next move and so on and so forth. So I like that. You know, it's you're about awareness. And really, yes. I think that's a big thing about us as humans. Are we mentally aware?
Right.
You know, because we're born, we're raised, we're the circumstances, there's events, there's things, we get bombarded with a lot of information. But are we really aware mentally and how that impacts us? That's a big question. How do we exercise that awareness?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like you would exercise your bicep. That's the way you think about it. You know, you have to have some exercise for it. So you have to do three sets of 15 reps, let's say, you know, if you're at the gym. What are the reps of the brain? That's what you got to create. It could be something like art, you know, some sort of practice that helps, you know, meditation, of course, but something that's like getting your brain to change. And so that's where mindfulness comes in. I mean, there is research that shows that mindfulness will, you know, increase, say, gray matter density in the brain, shift the amygdala nucleus. There's areas of the brain that kind of help us regulate that will change once they're practicing these things for the brain. But helping people figure out what that is for them. It could be hiking. Could be cooking. There's lots of things that you could do that are, do it with intention, without judgment, and in the present moment, that will help change your brain.
Well, thank you. Well, so Doc, you work with athletes, right? And the Rutgers team, right? And now, let's say this is something that we probably all wonder about. A team, I mean, there's a lot of teams, right? When they play, you know, not everybody wins. There is certainly one that fails, or they basically didn't make it. I mean, they got beat, right? How do you work the psyche with the team that actually, you know, kind of didn't succeed for that game, and to bring him back again to the play, the next one and the next one. Because, I mean, in tournaments, for example, you can have a bad day, you know, and sometimes you can have bad days, you know, back to back. How do you get them motivated enough to continue, you know, that, you know, it's not, don't live in that moment in the past, you know, that happened. How do you transfer their brain to really change the way they see themselves and potentially keep up? Because I think that's a big problem for all of us. I mean, one little thing and then we kind of like fall back.
Yeah.
And there's no falling back in athletics, especially if you're in a tournament and then you want to go after a big, you know, goal. So how do we do that?
Yeah. I mean, so I work with other universities and professional teams as well. So I think it varies from sport to sport. So if you think about it, you know, baseball, you could have two or three games in a day. Or like a weekend of six or four, you know, 4 to 6 games. So you have an you sort of need to let go. Football's once a week. You know, if it's bye week, it's once every 2 weeks. Basketball's like one or two a week, you know, so there's this variety in how people's brain need to let go. But the commonality there is that everything needs to let go. And how do you do it? I mean, it just varies from you know, team to team, culture to culture, sport to sport. There's different sort of personalities that end up in different sports. And, you know, some people are just better at this, you know, like some people, you know, I've had some guys come in or girls and they're just inherently kind of present. You know, you don't see it very often, but there are just some people. And those are usually very special people, both, you know, they're the teammate that is, you know, super connected or, you know, really able to kind of help, you know, the entire team kind of get where they need to get. But, you know, it takes practice, bottom line, you know. And so if it's a team of, you know, 10 or 110, it's got to kind of trickle down. One of the things that I'm doing now at this point in my career is also, you know, working with executives like the C-suite or even of professional teams or organizations or coaches, because that's, you know, the top-down approach. And so the healthier they are, the better that they'll be as well. And so kind of thinking about that holistically from the entire system.
Well, you know, the idea of, like, for example, in the corporate world, we use a lot of athletic, you know, imagery or leadership skills or training, you know, concepts that are almost like interchangeable between the two, right? You know, and I've used them in trainings myself. Like, we, you know, watch movies, for example, sports movies, and kind of depict the idea of leadership and teamwork and so on and so forth. But what, you know, again, there's the individual. So there's that mental piece, but there's also the impact of the team itself, you know. So that correlation, how does that even work in terms of just the connection? Because sometimes you can have a bad team because they're not willing to work with each other.
Yeah.
You know, so how do we, and we see that in those trainings or these kind of movies where you take a very dismantled, you know, group of people completely off, and you put them and mold them into this successful unit.
Yeah.
But it takes a lot of mental work to do that for them and for whoever's coaching. And by the way, that goes also for the corporate, because to get a team to be successful, you know, and high performing, it takes a lot of work.
It does. And, you know, that's the art of what we do. So some of that's borrowed from like organizational psychology, like thinking about the system at play. And so, on one hand, corporate has borrowed from sports because they like that the sports psychologist can come in and performance. But we learn a lot from organizational science, you know, for sports, you know, looking at roles of people in the locker room, roles of people on the field, roles of people out in the community. You know, those are things that really impact that cohesiveness. And so that's what you're talking about, is how do you build connection within a team? You know, there's an art and a science to it. And I think finding that sweet spot is one of the things that I guess people bring me in to do, is like helping them figure out what is the sweet spot to create that connection. And there's, you know, different strategies for doing that. And, you know, one thing that comes to mind is just like a shared mission, you know, and it can't just be like win a Super Bowl, you know, because that's just so generic. But I think coming in about, you know, something that is like mission oriented, kind of feels, you know, makes people feel like they're part of the system is key. And, you know, we can learn from Silicon Valley around some of that, because, you know, wellness is also a big piece of this. So it's not just grind. I mean, you got to grind, but you also have to have the meditation room and the snack bar, you know, and the gym, and, you know, creating the environment that says, hey, we want you to be well.
Well, so you mentioned meditation and Zen, you know, a couple of times. So what's, it sounds like that is a big part of who we are and what we should be doing to be better. Yeah. What's your take on that? I mean, you mentioned a few times, so I know it's big, but how, you know, what level should we really take into, I mean, if someone is watching right now listening and they have not even entertained the idea of that, you know, what would you tell them? Because you obviously use it and it's effective in the work you do. I guess for everyone else, we should all start. And by the way, this is something that came up many discussions over where there's almost a discussion about some sort of meditation level. So if you can just, you know, reinforce that for our audiences.
Yeah, it's powerful. I mean, the thing about it is, like, you know, doing bicep curls, you'll see the outcome of that, you know, in a short amount of time. Like, you'll get stronger bicep, maybe it gets a little bit bigger. You can see it. It's very measurable. It's really hard to measure the outcome of meditation. You know, like, no one could see their brain. You know, we have some imaging, but I'm not sure that anybody has access to an MRI machine just for fun. You know, it's not a really easy concept. Or even just looking at, like, the activity of the brain. You know, there's definitely some brain neurocatch or other sort of mechanisms out there that help, say, like an EEG or EKG, like, look at how the brain is operating. These are things that, again, don't the general population don't understand. But meditation absolutely has a, you know, positive impact on all these faculties of the body. And I've never heard anyone say, "Oh, I really wish I didn't just meditate this morning." You know, I had an athlete just say to me yesterday, "I know I felt best when I was meditating regularly, you know, and I just fell off a little bit." And that's okay. Like, you will fall off, you know, like anything else. There's sometimes, you know, you have a really great week of eating, and then you just kind of binge a little bit or get off the wagon. That's cool. Like, that's fine. Just get back on. That's all. Like, that's what's key.
So the frequency should be a consistent one, not like every now and then, just, you know, because if not, you'll lose the flavor of that, right?
Maybe. I mean, I start with whatever. You know, I think anything's better than nothing. And so if it is
Fair.
infrequent, cool. You know, like, that's sort of the approach. Ideally, you know, so my practice is typically about, at this point with my schedule, like 20, 30 minutes in the morning, 20, 30 minutes at night. And so, you know, historically you did it at sunrise and sunset. And so, you know, some sort of cadence like that is probably the best. But if it's 30 seconds, that's fine. You know, like, if it's a minute, if it's just that moment to just say, "I'm going to slow down for a second, put my devices down, and just be," that's helpful.
Well, but what would you tell someone who says, "I don't have time"? I mean, we, because that's the biggest excuse we hear all the time. Like, "Oh, there's no time." You know, I mean, we should make the time for these things, and I think that's the biggest part of sacrificing certain things for better things. And this is one that you want to kind of replace whatever it is you're doing. This is something like that, and working out, for example, are almost the mandatory pieces of our lives.
Non-negotiables.
I love that non-negotiable. Yeah.
You know, there's always time. You know, I mean, I work with, again, very high performing folks that are doing big things, and everyone can find time. You know, time is a made up construct from the human existence. So it's, you know, it's what it is. It's whatever you make it. And so you want to have time. You know, how important are you? You know, you'd find time to scroll on an Instagram or TikTok or something, you know. So put that down for a minute. You know, that's pretty simple, actually, because I look at some of the screen time numbers, and it's really, and so look at your screen time numbers. Like, how much time are you spending on your devices? There's your time for meditation.
Wow. I mean, when you put it that way, it sounds so simple. And, you know, and yet it is simple. I mean, literally, as you said, I mean, we just have to be, again, it goes back to that awareness. Like, once you start being aware and know what needs to be done, then maybe, but a lot of people don't have guidance, so they don't have someone to assist them. I think they people kind of wing things, right? This discussion, for example, can guide someone that may want to do all the good stuff, but they still have no idea how to do it. And I think you've covered quite a few items right now that just by following some of the advice you kind of shared with us today, that can make a difference.
That's
So.
a good, it's a good point. I mean, one of the things about meditation is that it is very effective when it's done in community. And so if you could have some accountability community, if you will, that would help, and you know, and create some success. That's what people do, like the gym or any sort of habit. And then, of course, like, all my athletes love to, like, cite some book they read about, "Well, it takes 7 days to make a habit." That's cute. It might, you know, But if it were that simple, and I didn't mean to say it was simple of just like put your phone down and meditate. I mean, that's hard because the phones were meant to addict us, and they are. They're very addicting, and they were very successful in creating that addiction. And so it will be very hard to put it down, but you will benefit from putting it down.
Well, thank you. Now, you talking in the context of Rutgers and younger folks, right? I mean, when you're at that age, you know, in college days and stuff, I mean, it takes, you know, you're still, the future is ahead of you. What are some of the tips you would give to people that want to succeed in their life? And maybe they're not in the athletic world, but they want to just be better and do certain things and really be prepared mentally for whatever that's going to come to them. Because I think there's also a generational thing. I mean, not all generations are equal in terms of how they see things. And we hear the debates between the Z's and the X's and, you know, and all these alphabets, right? And so we have different behaviors, right? And so every one of us kind of sees the world differently. I mean, there's a lot of talk about, for example, Generation Z or G's. G
Gen Z.
Gen Z, there you go. The Gen Zs are having difficulty, for example, at work and stuff because they're not focused or they are, you know, and again, I'm not judging, I'm just sharing some of the stuff that I hear. You know, how do we work with them to kind of get them, you know, an idea of what next steps would be and what they should be doing to actually get better and perform and certainly, you know, succeed in life?
I'm going to say the Gen Zs are actually more open to this than we are. That's kind of why they're judged, because they will put their well-being first, and they will kind of not work, you know, crazy hours. And it'd be curious to see what happens with the Gen Alphas who are emerging. It is what I like about, you know, being a college professor and being on that environment, is that I always like to say, especially from the psychology perspective, my job is to not have a job. And so if we can gain some of these tools from an earlier age, it's less likely that you're going to have crisis or, you know, mental health struggles when you get older. You know, sign me up. You know, that really inspires me. And that's the passion that, you know, that fire under me that says, like, I need to get this out more because this is what's going to help, you know, the next generation.
Thank you, Doc. Because there's a big point there. Because you're right. Like they're more flexible. They want to have a better, you know, life balance kind of concept. And historically, we were kind of like just laborers in a way. I don't care what level you are, white collar, blue collar, didn't matter. You were still, you know, kind of high expectation. You got to clock in 8 o'clock. You know, 9 o'clock p.m. Whatever. You know, and yes. So there is a way to do that now with technology today. With the AI, with all, and that's the thing. I think that's the debate. You know, the tools that we have today were not existing then. I mean, you can ask ChatGPT anything you want, and you get stuff. And I'm just giving Chat as being the primary one. But there's many AIs right now, right? And we're just evolving to the next stage, right? So with them, I mean, like for example, the debate about using a calculator versus not using a calculator. It's just a simple thing. You know, I mean, they may like, why would I need a calculator? I could just, you know, ask the question and get the answer. Why would I have to think about it? And I think there's adaptation and we have to shift a little bit. And so you're right. There is, at the end of the day, every generation is slowly moving away and the new generation is going to be the future. So,
That's right.
and it has to be that. So I love what, you know, the way you look at it because, see, you have it from, because again, your work is in the mental space, so you can see it differently. The average person is not going to see it. That was like, no, because from an employer perspective, right? I have a business. I need people to be reliable, accountable. You know, what kind of nonsense is this? Like, you don't want to show up or you want to work remotely. And although I have to say, like, you know, we have this argument, well, not argument, but discussion recently about the pandemic really had proven that people can perform remotely. Before the pandemic, you couldn't possibly, you know, convince anyone that, you know, we can get the job done, even though if I'm not in office, you know, sitting at a cubicle or a desk, right? Now we can do it. And this has been proven, right? So it's changed the dynamic. So I guess to your point, Gen Z may have a better way of looking at it this way and moving on and adapting better. So the other adaptation to the new stuff and the constant improvement in technology innovation is going to shift, you know, how we do things, whether in athletics or in business. And we see that, of course. I mean, so, but it's a matter of just like, you know, these generation things. It's more about just adapting. I mean, I think there's a lot of people that are reluctant in change, and change is kind of like, you know, it's a
Oh,
must.
totally.
We need to accept change. And unfortunately, I think we all kind of hold on to some of our, you know, anchors from the past, like, you know, like, but it's a fact, right? I mean, do you find that is an actual truth about, you know, a lot of people out there that they're living in the past and really they don't want to move away from old styles of action?
Absolutely. Absolutely. People really dislike change. And so I love change, and that's kind of like a provocative thing to say. And you know, of course, I struggle with it from time to time, but the Zen meditation teaches us that everything's constantly changing, that nothing is forever. And so being able to let go and just not hold on to anything is really, really powerful.
Well, thank you, Doc. So I know we're kind of restricted in time because you have some stuff to do. But here's a question for you. Just you know, as we're wrapping up, you know, what would be some of the advice you would give to the audiences that are listening, especially the younger ones that want to really thrive?
Look at your values. You know, are there things that are you're missing? You know, what can you do to really commit to the next moment? Commit to things that are important to you. You know, it's a tough world. I will say that. I think it, you know, it's changed, and change is okay. I think right now there's a lot of like, you know, social media that's looking at like The Simpsons or some of these other cartoons that were like predicting some of these life events and stuff. And you know, conspiracy is cool to kind of engage in, but do so with boundaries. You know, do so in a healthy kind of way. You know, anything that's really consuming us is unhealthy. You know, no matter what it is. I mean, even if it's wellness. If I'm consumed with wellness, where I'm, you know, eating so clean and everything I'm doing is so strict, that's not healthy. Nothing should be that absolute, because in life, you know, there's not much that's absolute. And so, just trying to kind of understand that, accept that, and that will bring us. And I mentioned earlier, like peace and equanimity. Maybe you don't want that, but I think sometimes that's what we're trying to figure out with my clients is like, what's a goal? And I think that peace is always something people want. You know, like I just want to put my head on the pillow and just sleep well. You know, that's real. It takes that peace and that work of just radical acceptance of who you are, and then living fully, you know, with the present moment in your committed life will bring that.
Thank you. So essentially, being open-minded is a big piece of all this. I mean, really, be open-minded to everything. You know, understand that there's variations of things and a variety of things that can be available to us, and we just have to kind of move with the times and just be available. And to your point, no crazy stuff. Do not just overwhelm yourself in general, and therefore life can become a lot easier.
Yeah, being open-minded, we call it psychological flexibility. You know, can I see the world from a different perspective? That's all, you know, it's really hard to do, and that's just what I'm asking.
What is that mindset? Is that what you're referring to?
Well, that's
Or
a, yeah, it's probably part of it. I mean, mindset is also, you know, about sort of goal-driven stuff, you know, and growth mindset. Am I, op you know, do I want to grow? Or am I, you know, is my mindset that I'm perfectly okay where I am? You know, not one's better than the other. It's just understanding where your, you know, mindset is in this moment.
thank you. And we have a couple of minutes quickly. Just one more thing. So how can people work with you? I mean, obviously you work with athletics, but you also work with corporate and stuff. So how do people interact with you, and what kind of program do you have for them?
Official drpeak.com. I mean, everything's there to access all aspects of me. So the professor job, the sports psychology job, the corporate coaching. And so, yeah, I also have a couple books. And so I wrote, you know, one of my books. The first one is on mindfulness. So if anyone was interested in some of the things we talked about, it's a very, it's a general workbook on how to do mindfulness. It doesn't matter whether you're, you know, working in a bank, you know, cleaning or trading stocks. It really is for all people.
There you have it, folks. Right, you know, we could have spent more time, but I know Doctor has some other engagements, you know, this morning. But certainly we get the best of him, you know, in this particular, you know, time frame. So thank you so much, Doc, for being with us and sharing, you know, some wisdom that can be a really good value for all our listeners around the world. And certainly, folks, do check out his podcast. I'll have all the links, you know, so you can actually just click on that on the description show and be able to connect with him directly. All right, that's about it. Doc, thank you so much for being with us, man. Appreciate
Thanks,
you.
Hurricane. This was great. Keep doing your good work.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it. All right, folks, this is it. We're wrapping up our show for today. We'll be talking soon with a new show topic. I'm Hurricane H. Bye for now.